provinces discovered and conquered, such riches brought home for the king and for themselves, and that such terror has been spread among the infidels, such admiration excited in all mankind. For when, either in ancient or modern times, have such great exploits been achieved by so few against so many, over so many climes, across so many seas, over such distances by land, to subdue the unseen and unknown, whose deeds can be compared with those of Spain? Our Spaniards, being few in number, never having more than 200 or 300 men together, and sometimes only 100, and even fewer, have, in our times, conquered more territory than has ever been known before, or than all the faithful and infidel princes possess. I will only write, at present, of what befell in the conquest, and I will not write much in order to avoid prolixity. Governor Pizarro wished to obtain intelligence from some Indians who had come from Cajamarca, so he had them tortured. They confessed that they had heard that Atahualpa was waiting for the governor at Cajamarca. The governor then ordered us to advance. On reaching the entrance to Cajamarca, we saw the camp of Atahualpa at a distance of a league, in the skirts of the mountains. The Indians' camp looked like a very beautiful city. They had so many tents that we were all filled with great apprehension. Until then we had never seen anything like this in the Indies. It filled all our Spaniards with fear and confusion, but we could not show any fear or turn back, for if the Indians had sensed any weakness in us, even the Indians that we were bringing with us as guides would have killed us. So we made a show of good spirits, and after carefully observing the town and the tents, we descended into the valley and entered Cajamarca. We talked a lot among ourselves about what to do. All of us were full of fear because we were so few in number, and we had penetrated so far into a land where we could not hope to receive reinforcements. We all met with the governor to debate what we should undertake the next day. Few of us slept that night, and we kept watch in the square of Cajamarca, looking at the campfires of the Indian army. It was a frightening sight. Most of the campfires were on a hillside, and so close to each other that it looked like the sky brightly studded with stars. There was no distinction that night between the mighty and the lowly, or between foot soldiers and horsemen. Everyone carried out sentry duty fully armed. So too did the good old governor, who went about encouraging his men. The governor's brother, Hernando Pizarro, estimated the number of Indian soldiers there at 40,000. But he was telling a lie just to encourage us, for there were actually more than 80,000 Indians. On the next morning, a messenger from Atahualpa arrived, and the governor said to him, "Tell your lord to come when and how he pleases, and that, in what way soever he may come, I will receive him as a friend and brother. I pray that he may come quickly, for I desire to see him. No harm or insult will befall him." The governor concealed his troops around the square at Cajamarca, dividing the cavalry into two portions, of which he gave the command of one to his brother Hernando Pizarro, and the command of the other to Hernando de Soto. In like manner, he divided the infantry, he himself taking one part, and giving the other to his brother Juan Pizarro. At the same time, he ordered Pedro de Candia, with two or three infantrymen, to go with trumpets to a small fort in the plaza, and to station themselves there with a small piece of artillery. When all the Indians and Atahualpa with them had entered the plaza, the governor would give a signal to Candia and his men, after which they should start firing the gun, and the trumpets should sound, and at the sound of the trumpets the cavalry should dash out of the large court where they were waiting hidden in readiness. At noon, Atahualpa began to draw up his men and to approach. Soon we saw the entire plain full of Indians, halting periodically to wait for more Indians who kept filing out of the camp behind them. They kept filing out in separate detachments into the afternoon. The front detachments were now close to our camp, and still more troops kept issuing from the camp of the Indians. In front of Atahualpa went 2,000 Indians who swept the road ahead of him, and these were followed by the warriors, half of whom were marching in the fields on one side of him and half on the other side. First came a squadron of Indians dressed in clothes of different colors, like a chessboard. They advanced, removing the straws from the ground and sweeping the road. Next came three squadrons in different dresses, dancing and singing. Then came a number of men with armor, large metal plates, and crowns of gold and silver. So great was the amount of furniture of gold and silver which they bore that it was a marvel to observe how the sun glinted upon it. Among them came the figure of Atahualpa in a very fine litter, with the ends of its timbers covered in silver. 80 lords carried him on their shoulders, all wearing a very rich blue livery. Atahualpa himself was very richly dressed, with his crown on his head and his collar of large emeralds around his neck. He sat on a small stool with a rich saddle cushion resting on his litter. The litter was lined with parrot feathers of many colors and decorated with plates of gold and silver. Behind Atahualpa came two other litters and two hammocks, in which were some high chiefs, then several squadrons of Indians with crowns of gold and silver. These Indian squadrons began to enter the plaza to the accompaniment of great songs. And thus entering, they occupied every part of the plaza. In the meantime, all of us Spaniards were waiting ready, hidden in a courtyard, full of fear. Many of us urinated without noticing it, out of sheer terror. On reaching the center of the plaza, Atahualpa remained in his litter on high, while his troops continued to file in behind him. Governor Pizarro now sent Friar Vicente de Valverde to go speak to Atahualpa and to require Atahualpa in the name of God and of the King of Spain that Atahualpa subject himself to the law of our Lord Jesus Christ and to the service of His Majesty the King of Spain. Advancing with a cross in one hand and the Bible in the other hand, and going among the Indian troops up to the place where Atahualpa was, the friar thus addressed him, "I am a priest of God, and I teach Christians the things of God, and in like manner I come to teach you. What I teach is that which God says to us in this book. Therefore, on the part of God and of the Christians, I beseech you to be their friend, for such is God's will, and it will be for your good." Atahualpa asked for the book, that he might look at it, and the friar gave it to him closed. Atahualpa did not know how to open the book, and the friar was extending his arm to do so, when Atahualpa, in great anger, gave him a blow on the arm, not wishing that it should be opened. Then he opened it himself, and without any astonishment at the letters and paper, he threw it away from him 5 or 6 paces, his face a deep crimson. The friar returned to Pizarro, shouting, come out, Christians! Come at these enemy dogs who reject the things of God. That tyrant has thrown my book of holy law to the ground. Did you not see what happened? Why remain polite and servile toward this overproud dog when the plains are full of Indians? March out against him, for I absolve you." The governor then gave the signal to Candia, who began to fire off the guns. At the same time the trumpets were sounded, and the armored Spanish troops, both cavalry and infantry, sallied forth out of their hiding places, straight into the mass of unarmed Indians crowding the square, giving the Spanish battle cry, "Santiago!" We had placed rattles on the horses to terrify the Indians. The booming of the guns, the blowing of the trumpets, and the rattles on the horses threw the Indians into panicked confusion. The Spaniards fell upon them and began to cut them to pieces. The Indians were so filled with fear that they climbed on top of one another, formed mounds, and suffocated each other. Since they were unarmed, they were attacked without danger to any Christian. The cavalry rode them down, killing and wounding and following in pursuit. The infantry made so good an assault on those that remained that, in a short time, most of them were put to the sword. The governor himself took his sword and dagger, entered the thick of the Indians with the Spaniards who were with him, and with great bravery reached Atahualpa's litter. He fearlessly grabbed Atahualpa's left arm and shouted, "Santiago!" But he could not pull Atahualpa out of his litter because it was held up high. Although we killed the Indians who held the litter, others at once took their places and held it aloft, and in this manner we spent a long time in overcoming and killing Indians. Finally, 7 or 8 Spaniards on horseback, spurred on their horses, rushed upon the litter from one side, and with great effort they heaved it over on its side. In that way, Atahualpa was captured, and the governor took Atahualpa to his lodging. The Indians carrying the litter, and those escorting Atahualpa, never abandoned him. All died around him. The panic-stricken Indians remaining in the square, terrified at the firing of the guns and at the horses, something they had never seen, tried to flee from the square by knocking down a stretch of wall and running out onto the plain outside. Our cavalry jumped the broken wall and charged into the plain, shouting, "Chase those with the fancy clothes! Don't let any escape! Spear them!" All the other Indian soldiers whom Atahualpa had brought were a mile from Cajamarca ready for battle, but not one made a move, and during all this not one Indian raised a weapon against a Spaniard. When the squadrons of Indians who had remained in the plain outside the town saw the other Indians fleeing and shouting, most of them too panicked and fled. It was an astounding sight, for the whole valley, for 15 or 20 miles, was completely filled with Indians. Night had already fallen, and our cavalry were continuing to spear Indians in the fields, and we heard a trumpet calling for us to reassemble at camp. If night had not come on, few out of the more than 40,000 Indian troops would have been left alive. 6 or 7,000 Indians lay dead, and many more had their arms cut off and other wounds. Atahualpa himself admitted that we had killed 7,000 of his men in that battle. The man killed in one of the litters was his minister, the Lord of Chincha, of whom he was very fond. All those Indians who bore Atahualpa's litter appeared to be high chiefs and counselors. They were all killed, as well as those Indians who were carried in the other litters and hammocks. The Lord of Cajamarca was also killed, and others, but their numbers were so great that they could not be counted, for all who came in attendance on Atahualpa were great lords. It was extraordinary to see so powerful a ruler captured in so short a time when he had come with such a mighty army. Truly, it was not accomplished by our own forces, for there were so few of us. It was by the grace of God, which is great. Atahualpa's robes had been torn off when the Spaniards pulled him out of his litter. The governor ordered clothes to be brought to him, and when Atahualpa was dressed, the governor ordered Atahualpa to sit near him and soothed his rage and agitation at finding himself so quickly fallen from his high estate. The governor said to Atahualpa, "Do not take it as an insult that you have been defeated and taken prisoner. For with the Christians who come with me, though so few in number, I have conquered greater kingdoms than yours, and have defeated other more powerful lords than you, imposing upon them the dominion of the emperor, whose vassal I am, and who is king of Spain and of the universal world. We come to conquer this land by his command, that all may come to a knowledge of God and of his holy Catholic faith, and by reason of our good mission, God, the creator of heaven and earth, and of all things in them, permits this, in order that you may know him and come out from the bestial and diabolical life that you lead. It is for this reason that we, being so few in number, subjugate that vast host. When you have seen the errors in which you live, you will understand the good that we have done you by coming to your land by order of His Majesty the King of Spain. Our Lord permitted that your pride should be brought low, and that no Indian should be able to offend a Christian." Let us now trace the chain of causation in this extraordinary confrontation, beginning with the immediate events. When Pizarro and Atahualpa met at Cajamarca, why did Pizarro capture Atahualpa and kill so many of his followers, instead of Atahualpa's vastly more numerous forces capturing and killing Pizarro? After all, Pizarro had only 62 soldiers mounted on horses, along with 106 foot soldiers, while Atahualpa commanded an army of about 80,000. As for the antecedents of those events, how did Atahualpa come to be at Cajamarca at all? How did Pizarro come to be there to capture him, instead of Atahualpa's coming to Spain to capture King Charles I? Why did Atahualpa walk into what seems to us, with the gift of hindsight, to have been such a transparent trap? Did the factors acting in the encounter of Atahualpa and Pizarro also play a broader role in encounters between Old World and New World peoples and between other peoples? Why did Pizarro capture Atahualpa? Pizarro's military advantages lay in the Spaniards' steel swords and other weapons, steel armor, guns, and horses. To those weapons, Atahualpa's troops, without animals on which to ride into battle, could oppose only stone, bronze, or wooden clubs, maces and hand axes, plus slingshots and quilted armor. Such imbalances of equipment were decisive in innumerable other confrontations of Europeans with Native Americans and other peoples. The sole Native Americans able to resist European conquest for many centuries were those tribes that reduced the military disparity by acquiring and mastering both horses and guns. To the average white American, the word Indian conjures up an image of a mounted Plains Indian brandishing a rifle, like the Sioux warriors who annihilated General George Custer's U.S. Army battalion at the famous Battle of the Little Big Horn in 1876. We easily forget that horses and rifles were originally unknown to Native Americans. They were brought by Europeans and proceeded to transform the societies of Indian tribes that acquired them. Thanks to their mastery of horses and rifles, the Plains Indians of North America, the Araucanian Indians of southern Chile, and the Pampas Indians of Argentina fought off invading whites longer than did any other Native Americans, succumbing only to massive army operations by white governments in the 1870s and 1880s. Today it is hard for us to grasp the enormous numerical odds against which the Spaniards' military equipment prevailed. At the Battle of Cajamarca, recounted above, 168 Spaniards crushed a Native American army 500 times more numerous, killing thousands of natives while not losing a single Spaniard. Time and again, accounts of Pizarro's subsequent battles with the Incas, Cortez's conquest of the Aztecs, and other early European campaigns against Native Americans describe encounters in which a few dozen European horsemen routed thousands of Indians with great slaughter. During Pizarro's march from Cajamarca to the Inca capital of Cuzco after Atahualpa's death, there were four such battles at Yauja, Vilcaswaman, Vilcaconga, and Cuzco. Those four battles involved a mere 80, 30, 110, and 40 Spanish horsemen, respectively, in each case ranged against thousands or tens of thousands of Indians. These Spanish victories cannot be written off as due merely to the help of Native American allies, to the psychological novelty of Spanish weapons and horses, or, as is often claimed, to the Incas mistaking Spaniards for their returning god Viracocha. The initial successes of both Pizarro and Cortés did attract Native allies. However, many of them would not have become allies if they had not already been persuaded by earlier devastating successes of unassisted Spaniards, that resistance was futile, and that they should side with the likely winners. The novelty of horses, steel weapons, and guns undoubtedly paralyzed the Incas at Cajamarca, but the battles after Cajamarca were fought against determined resistance by Inca armies that had already seen Spanish weapons and horses. Within half a dozen years of the initial conquest, Incas mounted two desperate, large-scale, well-prepared rebellions against the Spaniards. All those efforts failed because of the Spaniards' far superior armament. By the 1700s, guns had replaced swords as the main weapon favoring European invaders over Native Americans and other Native peoples. For example, in 1808, a British sailor named Charlie Savage, equipped with muskets and excellent aim, arrived in the Fiji Islands. The aptly named Savage proceeded single-handedly to upset Fiji's balance of power. Among his many exploits, he paddled his canoe up a river to the Fijian village of Kasavu, halted less than a pistol shot's length from the village fence, and fired away at the undefended inhabitants. His victims were so numerous that surviving villagers piled up the bodies to take shelter behind them, and the stream beside the village was red with blood. Such examples of the power of guns against native peoples lacking guns could be multiplied indefinitely. In the Spanish conquest of the Incas, guns played only a minor role. The guns of those times, so-called harquebuses, were difficult to load and fire, and Pizarro had only a dozen of them. They did produce a big psychological effect on those occasions when they managed to fire. Far more important were the Spaniards' steel swords, lances, and daggers, strong, sharp weapons that slaughtered thinly armored Indians. In contrast, Indian blunt clubs, while capable of battering and wounding Spaniards and their horses, rarely succeeded in killing them. The Spaniards' steel or chainmail armor, and above all, their steel helmets, usually provided an effective defense against club blows, while the Indians' quilted armor offered no protection against steel weapons. The tremendous advantage that the Spaniards gained from their horses leaps out of the eyewitness accounts. Horsemen could easily outride Indian sentries before the sentries had time to warn Indian troops behind them, and could ride down and kill Indians on foot. The shock of a horse's charge, its maneuverability, the speed of attack that it permitted, and the raised and protected fighting platform that it provided left foot soldiers nearly helpless in the open. Nor was the effect of horses due only to the terror that they inspired in soldiers fighting against them for the first time. By the time of the great Inca Rebellion of 1536, the Incas had learned how best to defend themselves against cavalry by ambushing and annihilating Spanish horsemen in narrow passes. But the Incas, like all other foot soldiers, were never able to defeat cavalry in the open. When Quiso Yupanqui, the best general of the Incan Emperor Manco, who succeeded Atahualpa, besieged the Spaniards in Lima in 1536 and tried to storm the city, two squadrons of Spanish cavalry charged a much larger Indian force on flat ground, killed Quiso and all of his commanders in the first charge, and routed his army. A similar cavalry charge of 26 horsemen routed the best troops of Emperor Manco himself as he was besieging the Spaniards in Cusco. The transformation of warfare by horses began with their domestication around 4000 BC in the steppes north of the Black Sea. Horses permitted people possessing them to cover far greater distances than was possible on foot, to attack by surprise, and to flee before a superior defending force could be gathered. Their role at Cajamarca thus exemplifies a military weapon that remained potent for 6,000 years, until the early 20th century, and that was eventually applied on all the continents. Not until the First World War did the military dominance of cavalry finally end. When we consider the advantages that Spaniards derived from horses, steel weapons, and armor against foot soldiers without metal, it should no longer surprise us that Spaniards consistently won battles against enormous odds. How did Atahualpa come to be at Cajamarca? Atahualpa and his army came to be at Cajamarca because they had just won decisive battles in the civil war that left the Incas divided and vulnerable. Pizarro quickly appreciated those divisions and exploited them. The reason for the civil war was that an epidemic of smallpox, spreading overland among South American Indians after its arrival with Spanish settlers in Panama and Colombia, had killed the Inca emperor Huayna Capac and most of his court around 1526, and then immediately killed his designated heir, Ninan Cuyuchi. Those deaths precipitated a contest for the throne between Atahualpa and his half-brother Huascar. If it had not been for the epidemic, the Spaniards would have faced a united empire. Atahualpa's presence at Cajamarca thus highlights one of the key factors in world history. Diseases transmitted to peoples lacking immunity by invading peoples with considerable immunity. Smallpox, measles, influenza, typhus, bubonic plague, and other infectious diseases endemic in Europe played a decisive role in European conquests by decimating many peoples on other continents. For example, a smallpox epidemic devastated the Aztecs after the failure of the first Spanish attack in 1520 and killed Cuitlahuac, the Aztec emperor who briefly succeeded Montezuma. Throughout the Americas, diseases introduced with Europeans spread from tribe to tribe far in advance of the Europeans themselves, killing an estimated 95% of the pre-Columbian Native American population. The most populous and highly organized Native societies of North America, the Mississippian chiefdoms, disappeared in that way between 1492 and the late 1600s, even before Europeans themselves made their first settlement on the Mississippi River. A smallpox epidemic in 1713 was the biggest single step in the destruction of South Africa's native San people by European settlers. Soon after the British settlement of Sydney in 1788, the first of the epidemics that decimated Aboriginal Australians began. A well-documented example from Pacific Islands is the epidemic that swept over Fiji in 1806, brought by a few European sailors who struggled ashore from the wreck of the ship Argo. Similar epidemics marked the histories of Tonga, Hawaii, and other Pacific Islands. I do not mean to imply, however, that the role of disease in history was confined to paving the way for European expansion. Malaria, yellow fever, and other diseases of tropical Africa, India, Southeast Asia, and New Guinea furnished the most important obstacle to European colonization of those tropical areas. How did Pizarro come to be at Cajamarca? Why didn't Atahualpa instead try to conquer Spain? Pizarro came to Cajamarca by means of European maritime technology, which built the ships that took him across the Atlantic from Spain to Panama, and then in the Pacific from Panama to Peru. Lacking such technology, Atahualpa did not expand overseas out of South America. In addition to the ships themselves, Pizarro's presence depended on the centralized political organization that enabled Spain to finance, build, staff, and equip the ships. The Inca Empire also had a centralized political organization, but that actually worked to its disadvantage, because Pizarro seized the Inca chain of command intact by capturing Atahualpa. Since the Inca bureaucracy was so strongly identified with its godlike absolute monarch, it disintegrated after Atahualpa's death. Maritime technology, coupled with political organization, was similarly essential for European expansions to other continents, as well as for expansions of many other peoples. A related factor bringing Spaniards to Peru was the existence of writing. Spain possessed it, while the Inca Empire did not. Information could be spread far more widely, more accurately, and in more detail, by writing than it could be transmitted by mouth. That information, coming back to Spain from Columbus's voyages and from Cortes's conquest of Mexico, sent Spaniards pouring into the New World. Letters and pamphlets supplied both the motivation and the necessary detailed sailing directions. The first published report of Pizarro's exploits by his companion Captain Cristobal de Mena was printed in Seville in April 1534, a mere 9 months after Atahualpa's execution. It became a bestseller, was rapidly translated into other European languages, and sent a further stream of Spanish colonists to tighten Pizarro's grip on Peru. Why did Atahualpa walk into the trap? In hindsight, we find it astonishing that Atahualpa marched into Pizarro's obvious trap at Cajamarca. The Spaniards who captured him were equally surprised at their success. The consequences of literacy are prominent in the ultimate explanation. The immediate explanation is that Atahualpa had very little information about the Spaniards, their military power, and their intent. He derived that scant information by word of mouth, mainly from an envoy who had visited Pizarro's force for 2 days while it was en route inland from the coast. That envoy saw the Spaniards at their most disorganized, told Atahualpa that they were not fighting men, and that he could tie them all up if given 200 Indians. Understandably, it never occurred to Atahualpa that the Spaniards were formidable and would attack him without provocation. In the New World, the ability to write was confined to small elites among some peoples of modern Mexico and neighboring areas far to the north of the Inca Empire. Although the Spanish conquest of Panama, a mere 600 miles from the Inca's northern boundary, began already in 1510, no knowledge even of the Spaniards' existence appears to have reached the Incas until Pizarro's first landing on the Peruvian coast in 1527. Atahualpa remained entirely ignorant about Spain's conquests of Central America's most powerful and populous Indian societies. As surprising to us today as Atahualpa's behavior leading to his capture, is his behavior thereafter. He offered his famous ransom in the naive belief that once paid off, the Spaniards would release him and depart. He had no way of understanding that Pizarro's men formed the spearhead of a force bent on permanent conquest rather than an isolated raid. Atahualpa was not alone in these fatal miscalculations. Even after Atahualpa had been captured, Francisco Pizarro's brother Hernando Pizarro deceived Atahualpa's leading general, Chalcochima, commanding a large army, into delivering himself to the Spaniards. Chalcochima's miscalculation marked a turning point in the collapse of Inca resistance, a moment almost significant as the capture of Atahualpa himself. The Aztec Emperor Montezuma miscalculated even more grossly when he took Cortes for a returning god and admitted him and his tiny army into the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan. The result was that Cortes captured Montezuma, then went on to conquer Tenochtitlan and the Aztec Empire. On a mundane level, the miscalculations by Atahualpa, Chalcochima, Montezuma, and countless other Native American leaders deceived by Europeans were due to the fact that no living inhabitants of the New World had been to the Old World. So, of course, they could have had no specific information about the Spaniards. Even so, we find it hard to avoid the conclusion that Atahualpa should have been more suspicious, if only his society had experienced a broader range of human behavior. Pizarro, too, arrived at Cajamarca with no information about the Incas, other than what he had learned by interrogating the Inca subjects he encountered in 1527 and 1531. However, while Pizarro himself happened to be illiterate, he belonged to a literate tradition. From books, the Spaniards knew of many contemporary civilizations remote from Europe, and about several thousand years of European history. Pizarro explicitly modeled his ambush of Atahualpa on the successful strategy of Cortes. In short, literacy made the Spaniards heir to a huge body of knowledge about human behavior and history. By contrast, not only did Atahualpa have no conception of the Spaniards themselves and no personal experience of any other invaders from overseas, but he also had not even heard or read of similar threats to anyone else, anywhere else, any time previously in history. That gulf of experience encouraged Pizarro to set his trap and Atahualpa to walk into it. Thus, Pizarro's capture of Atahualpa illustrates the set of proximate factors that resulted in Europeans colonizing the New World instead of Native Americans colonizing Europe. Immediate reasons for Pizarro's success included military technology based on guns, steel weapons and horses, infectious diseases endemic in Eurasia, European maritime technology, the centralized political organization of European states, and writing. The title of this book will serve as shorthand for those proximate factors, which also enabled modern Europeans to conquer peoples of other continents. Long before anyone began manufacturing guns and steel, others of those same factors had led to the expansion of some non-European peoples, as we shall see in later chapters. But we are still left with the fundamental question why all those immediate advantages came to lie more with Europe than with the New World. Why weren't the Incas the ones to invent guns and steel swords, to be mounted on animals as fearsome as horses, to bear diseases to which Europeans lacked resistance, to develop ocean-going ships and advance political organization, and to be able to draw on the experience of thousands of years of written history? Those are no longer the questions of proximate causation that this chapter has been discussing, but questions of ultimate causation that will take up the next two parts of this book. Part 2. The Rise and Spread of Food Production. Chapter 4. Farmer Power. As a teenager, I spent the summer of 1956 in Montana, working for an elderly farmer named Fred Hershey. Born in Switzerland, Fred had come to southwestern Montana as a teenager in the 1890s and proceeded to develop one of the first farms in the area. At the time of his arrival, much of the original Native American population of hunter-gatherers was still living there. My fellow farmhands were, for the most part, tough whites whose normal speech featured strings of curses and who spent their weekdays working so that they could devote their weekends to squandering their week's wages in the local saloon. Among the farmhands, though, was a member of the Blackfoot Indian tribe named Levi, who behaved very differently from the coarse miners, being polite, gentle, responsible, sober, and well-spoken. He was the first Indian with whom I had spent much time, and I came to admire him. It was therefore a shocking disappointment to me when, one Sunday morning, Levi, too, staggered in drunk and cursing after a Saturday night binge. Among his curses, one has stood out in my memory. "Damn you, Fred Hershey, and damn the ship that brought you from Switzerland." It poignantly brought home to me the Indian's perspective on what I, like other white schoolchildren, had been taught to view as the heroic conquest of the American West. Fred Hershey's family was proud of him as a pioneer farmer who had succeeded under difficult conditions. But Levi's tribe of hunters and famous warriors had been robbed of its lands by the immigrant white farmers. How did the farmers win out over the famous warriors? For most of the time, since the ancestors of modern humans diverged from the ancestors of the living great apes around 7 million years ago, all humans on Earth fed themselves exclusively by hunting wild animals and gathering wild plants, as the Blackfeet still did in the 19th century. It was only within the last 11,000 years that some peoples turned to what is termed food production, that is, domesticating wild animals and plants and eating the resulting livestock and crops. Today, most people on Earth consume food that they produce themselves, or that someone else produced for them. At current rates of change, within the next decade, the few remaining bands of hunter-gatherers will abandon their ways, disintegrate, or die out, thereby ending our millions of years of commitment to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Different peoples acquired food production at different times in prehistory. Some, such as Aboriginal Australians, never acquired it at all. Of those who did, some, for example the ancient Chinese, developed it independently by themselves, while others, including ancient Egyptians, acquired it from neighbors. But, as we'll see, food production was indirectly a prerequisite for the development of guns, germs, and steel. Hence, geographic variation in whether or when the peoples of different continents became farmers and herders explains to a large extent their subsequent contrasting fates. Before we devote the next six chapters to understanding how geographic differences in food production arose, this chapter will trace the main connections through which food production led to all the advantages that enabled Pizarro to capture Atahualpa and Fred Hershey's people to dispossess Levi's. The first connection is the most direct one. Availability of more consumable calories means more people. Among wild plants and animal species, only a small minority are edible to humans or worth hunting or gathering. Most species are useless to us as food, for one or more of the following reasons. They are indigestible, like bark, poisonous, monarch butterflies and deathcap mushrooms, low in nutritional value, jellyfish, tedious to prepare, very small nuts, difficult to gather, larvae of most insects, or dangerous to hunt, rhinoceroses. Most biomass, living biological matter, on land, is in the form of wood and leaves, most of which we cannot digest. By selecting and growing those few species of plants and animals that we can eat, so that they constitute 90% rather than 0.1% of the biomass on an acre of land, we obtain far more edible calories per acre. As a result, one acre can feed many more herders and farmers, typically 10 to 100 times more, than hunter-gatherers. That strength of brute numbers was the first of many military advantages that food-producing tribes gained over hunter-gatherer tribes. In human societies possessing domestic animals, livestock fed more people in four distinct ways, by furnishing meat, milk, and fertilizer, and by pulling plows. First, and most directly, domestic animals became the society's major source of animal protein, replacing wild game. Today, for instance, Americans tend to get most of their animal protein from cows, pigs, sheep, and chickens, with game such as venison just a rare delicacy. In addition, some big domestic mammals served as sources of milk and of milk products such as butter, cheese, and yogurt. Milk-fed mammals include the cow, sheep, goat, horse, reindeer, water buffalo, yak, and Arabian and Bactrian camels. Those mammals thereby yield several times more calories over their lifetime than if they were just slaughtered and consumed as meat. Big domestic mammals also interacted with domestic plants in two ways to increase crop production. First, as any modern gardener or farmer still knows by experience, crop yields can be greatly increased by manure applied as fertilizer. Even with the modern availability of synthetic fertilizers produced by chemical factories, the major source of crop fertilizer today in most societies is still animal manure, especially of cows, but also of yaks and sheep. Manure has been valuable, too, as a source of fuel for fires in traditional societies. In addition, the largest domestic mammals interacted with domestic plants to increase food production by pulling plows and thereby making it possible for people to till land that had previously been uneconomical for farming. Those plow animals were the cow, horse, water buffalo, valley cattle, and yak-cow hybrids. Here is one example of their value. The first prehistoric farmers of Central Europe, the so-called linear bond keramik culture that arose slightly before 5000 BC, were initially confined to soils light enough to be tilled by means of handheld digging sticks. Only over 1,000 years later, with the introduction of the ox-drawn plow, were those farmers able to extend cultivation to a much wider range of heavy soils and tough sods. Similarly, Native American farmers of the North American Great Plains grew crops in the river valleys, but farming of the tough sods on the extensive uplands had to await 19th-century Europeans and their animal-drawn plows. All those are direct ways in which plant and animal domestication led to denser human populations by yielding more food than did the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. A more indirect way involved the consequences of the sedentary lifestyle enforced by food production. People of many hunter-gatherer societies move frequently in search of wild foods, but farmers must remain near their fields and orchards. The resulting fixed abode contributes to denser human populations by permitting a shortened birth interval. A hunter-gatherer mother who is shifting camp can carry only one child, along with her few possessions. She cannot afford to bear her next child until the previous toddler can walk fast enough to keep up with the tribe and not hold it back. In practice, nomadic hunter-gatherers space their children about 4 years apart by means of lactational amenorrhea, sexual abstinence, infanticide, and abortion. By contrast, sedentary people, unconstrained by problems of carrying young children on treks, can bear and raise as many children as they can feed. The birth interval for many farm peoples is around 2 years, half that of hunter-gatherers. That higher birth rate of food producers, together with their ability to feed more people per acre, lets them achieve much higher population densities than hunter-gatherers. A separate consequence of a settled existence is that it permits one to store food surpluses, since storage would be pointless if one didn't remain nearby to guard the stored food. While some nomadic hunter-gatherers may occasionally bag more food than they can consume in a few days, such a bonanza is of little use to them because they cannot protect it. But stored food is essential for feeding non-food-producing specialists, and certainly for supporting whole towns of them. Hence, nomadic hunter-gatherer societies have few or no such full-time specialists, who instead first appear in sedentary societies. Two types of such specialists are kings and bureaucrats. Hunter-gatherer societies tend to be relatively egalitarian. To lack full-time bureaucrats and hereditary chiefs, and to have small-scale political organization at the level of the band or tribe. That's because all able-bodied hunter-gatherers are obliged to devote much of their time to acquiring food. In contrast, once food can be stockpiled, a political elite can gain control of food produced by others, assert the right of taxation, escape the need to feed itself, and engage full-time in political activities. Hence, moderate-sized agricultural societies are often organized in chiefdoms, and kingdoms are confined to large agricultural societies. Those complex political units are much better able to mount a sustained war of conquest than is an egalitarian band of hunters. Some hunter-gatherers in especially rich environments, such as the Pacific Northwest coast of North America and the coast of Ecuador, also developed sedentary societies, food storage, and nascent chiefdoms, but they did not go farther on the road to kingdoms. A stored food surplus built up by taxation can support other full-time specialists besides kings and bureaucrats. Of most direct relevance to wars of conquest, it can be used to feed professional soldiers. That was the decisive factor in the British Empire's eventual defeat of New Zealand's well-armed indigenous Maori population. While the Maori achieved some stunning temporary victories, they could not maintain an army constantly in the field and were in the end worn down by 18,000 full-time British troops. Stored food can also feed priests, who provide religious justification for wars of conquest. Artisans, such as metal workers, who develop swords, guns, and other technologies, and scribes, who preserve far more information than can be remembered accurately. So far, I've emphasized direct and indirect values of crops and livestock as food. However, they have other uses, such as keeping us warm and providing us with valuable materials. Crops and livestock yield natural fibers for making clothing, blankets, nets, and rope. Most of the major centers of plant domestication evolved not only food crops, but also fiber crops, notably cotton, flax, the source of linen, and hemp. Several domestic animals yielded animal fibers, especially wool from sheep, goats, llamas, and alpacas, and silk from silkworms. Bones of domestic animals were important raw materials for artifacts of Neolithic peoples before the development of metallurgy. Cow hides were used to make leather. One of the earliest cultivated plants in many parts of the Americas was grown for non-food purposes, the bottle gourd, used as a container. Big domestic mammals further revolutionized human society by becoming our main means of land transport until the development of railroads in the 19th century. Before animal domestication, the sole means of transporting goods and people by land was on the backs of humans. Large mammals changed that. For the first time in human history, it became possible to move heavy goods in large quantities, as well as people, rapidly overland for long distances. The domestic animals that were ridden were the horse, donkey, yak, reindeer, and Arabian and Bactrian camels. Animals of those same five species, as well as the llama, were used to bear packs. Cows and horses were hitched to wagons, while reindeer and dogs pulled sleds in the Arctic. The horse became the chief means of long-distance transport over most of Eurasia. The three domestic camel species, Arabian camel, Bactrian camel, and llama, played a similar role in areas of North Africa and Arabia, Central Asia, and the Andes, respectively. The most direct contribution of plant and animal domestication to wars of conquest was from Eurasia's horses, whose military role made them the jeeps and Sherman tanks of ancient warfare on that continent. As I mentioned in Chapter 3, they enabled Cortes and Pizarro, leading only small bands of adventurers, to overthrow the Aztec and Inca empires. Even much earlier, around 4000 BC, at a time when horses were still ridden bareback, they may have been the essential military ingredient behind the westward expansion of speakers of Indo-European languages from the Ukraine. Those languages eventually replaced all earlier Western European languages, except Basque. When horses later were yoked to wagons and other vehicles, horse-drawn battle chariots invented around 1800 BC proceeded to revolutionize warfare in the Near East, the Mediterranean region, and China. For example, in 1674 BC, horses even enabled a foreign people, the Hyksos, to conquer then horseless Egypt and to establish themselves temporarily as pharaohs. Still later, after the invention of saddles and stirrups, horses allowed the Huns and successive waves of other peoples from the Asian steppes to terrorize the Roman Empire and its successor states, culminating in the Mongol conquests of much of Asia and Russia in the 13th and 14th centuries AD. Only with the introduction of trucks and tanks in World War I did horses finally become supplanted as the main assault vehicle and means of fast transport in war. Arabian and Bactrian camels played a similar military role within their geographic range. In all these examples, peoples with domestic horses or camels, or with improved means of using them, enjoyed an enormous military advantage over those without them. Of equal importance in wars of conquest were the germs that evolved in human societies and with domestic animals. Infectious diseases like smallpox, measles, and flu arose as specialized germs of humans, derived by mutations of very similar ancestral germs that had infected animals. The humans who domesticated animals were the first to fall victim to the newly evolved germs, but those humans then evolved substantial resistance to the new diseases. When such partly immune people came into contact with others who had had no previous exposure to the germs, epidemics resulted in which up to 99% of the previously unexposed population was killed. Germs thus acquired ultimately from domestic animals played decisive roles in the European conquests of Native Americans, Australians, South Africans, and Pacific Islanders. In short, plant and animal domestication meant much more food and hence much denser human populations. The resulting food surpluses, and in some areas the animal-based means of transporting those surpluses, were a prerequisite for the development of settled, politically centralized, socially stratified, economically complex, technologically innovative societies. Hence the availability of domestic plants and animals ultimately explains why empires, literacy, and steel weapons developed earliest in Eurasia and later, or not at all, on other continents. The military uses of horses and camels, and the killing power of animal-derived germs, complete the list of major links between food production and conquest that we shall be exploring. Chapter 5. History's Haves and Have-Nots. Much of human history has consisted of unequal conflicts between the haves and the have-nots, between peoples with farmer power and those without it, or between those who acquired it at different times. It should come as no surprise that food production never arose in large areas of the globe, for ecological reasons that still make it difficult or impossible there today. For instance, neither farming nor herding developed in prehistoric times in North America's Arctic, while the sole element of food production to arise in Eurasia's Arctic was reindeer herding. Nor could food production spring up spontaneously in deserts remote from sources of water for irrigation, such as Central Australia and parts of the western United States. Instead, what cries out for explanation is the failure of food production to appear, until modern times, in some ecologically very suitable areas that are among the world's richest centers of agriculture and herding today. Foremost among these puzzling areas, where indigenous peoples were still hunter-gatherers when European colonists arrived, were California and the other Pacific states of the United States, the Argentine Pampas, southwestern and southeastern Australia, and much of the Cape region of South Africa. Had we surveyed the world in 4000 BC, thousands of years after the rise of food production in its oldest sites of origin, we would have been surprised, too, at several other modern breadbaskets that were still then without it, including all the rest of the United States, England, and much of France, Indonesia, and all of sub-equatorial Africa. When we trace food production back to its beginnings, the earliest sites provide another surprise. Far from being modern breadbaskets, they include areas ranking today as somewhat dry or ecologically degraded: Iraq and Iran, Mexico, the Andes, parts of China, and Africa's Sahel zone. Why did food production develop first in these seemingly rather marginal lands and only later in today's most fertile farmlands and pastures? Geographic differences in the means by which food production arose are also puzzling. In a few places, it developed independently as a result of local people domesticating local plants and animals. In most other places, it was instead imported in the form of crops and livestock that had been domesticated elsewhere. Since those areas of non-independent origins were suitable for prehistoric food production as soon as domesticates had arrived, why did the peoples of those areas not become farmers and herders without outside assistance by domesticating local plants and animals? Among those regions where food production did spring up independently, why did the times at which it appeared vary so greatly? For example, thousands of years earlier in eastern Asia than in the eastern United States, and never in eastern Australia. Among those regions into which it was imported in the prehistoric era, why did the date of arrival also vary so greatly? For example, thousands of years earlier in southwestern Europe than in the southwestern United States. Again, among those regions where it was imported, why in some areas, such as the southwestern United States, did local hunter-gatherers themselves adopt crops and livestock from neighbors and survive as farmers, while in other areas such as Indonesia and much of sub-equatorial Africa, the importation of food production involved a cataclysmic replacement of the region's original hunter-gatherers by invading food producers? All these questions involve developments that determined which peoples became history's have-nots and which became its haves. Before we can hope to answer these questions, we need to figure out how to identify areas where food production originated, when it arose there, and where and when a given crop or animal was first domesticated. The most unequivocal evidence comes from identification of plant and animal remains at archaeological sites. Most domesticated plant and animal species differ morphologically from their wild ancestors. For example, in the smaller size of domestic cattle and sheep, the larger size of domestic chickens and apples, the thinner and smoother seed coats of domestic peas, and the corkscrew-twisted rather than scimitar-shaped horns of domestic goats. Hence, remains of domesticated plants and animals at a dated archaeological site can be recognized and provide strong evidence of food production at that place and time, whereas finding the remains only of wild species at a site fails to provide evidence of food production and is compatible with hunting-gathering. Naturally, food producers, especially early ones, continued to gather some wild plants and hunt wild animals, so the food remains at their sites often include wild species as well as domesticated ones. Archaeologists date food production by radiocarbon dating of carbon-containing materials at the site. This method is based on the slow decay of radioactive carbon-14, a very minor component of carbon, the ubiquitous building block of life, into the non-radioactive isotope nitrogen-14. Carbon-14 is continually being generated in the atmosphere by cosmic rays. Plants take up atmospheric carbon, which has a known and approximately constant ratio of carbon-14 to the prevalent isotope carbon-12, a ratio of about 1 to a million. That plant carbon goes on to form the body of the herbivorous animals that eat the plants and of the carnivorous animals that eat those herbivorous animals. Once the plant or animal dies, though, half of its carbon-14 content decays into carbon-12 every 5,700 years, until after about 40,000 years, the carbon-14 content is very low and difficult to measure or to distinguish from contamination with small amounts of modern materials containing carbon-14. Hence, the age of material from an archaeological site can be calculated from the material's carbon-14, carbon-12 ratio. Radiocarbon is plagued by numerous technical problems, of which two deserve mention here. One is that radiocarbon dating until the 1980s required relatively large amounts of carbon, a few grams, much more than the amount in small seeds or bones. Hence, scientists instead often had to resort to dating material recovered nearby at the same site and believed to be associated with the food remains, that is, to have been deposited simultaneously by the people who left the food. A typical choice of associated material is charcoal from fires. But archaeological sites are not always neatly sealed time capsules of materials all deposited on the same day. Materials deposited at different times can get mixed together as worms and rodents and other agents churn up the ground. Charcoal residues from a fire can thereby end up close to the remains of a plant or animal that died and was eaten thousands of years earlier or later. Increasingly today, archaeologists are circumventing this problem by a new technique termed accelerator mass spectrometry, which permits radiocarbon dating of tiny samples and thus lets one directly date a single small seed, small bone, or other food residue. In some cases, big differences have been found between recent radiocarbon dates based on the direct new methods, which have their own problems, and those based on the indirect older ones. Among the resulting controversies remaining unresolved, perhaps the most important for the purposes of this book, concerns the date when food production originated in the Americas. Indirect methods of the 1960s and 1970s yielded dates as early as 7,000 BC. But more recent direct dating has been yielding dates no earlier than 3,500 BC. A second problem in radiocarbon dating is that the carbon-14, carbon-12 ratio of the atmosphere is in fact not rigidly constant, but fluctuates slightly with time. So calculations of radiocarbon dates based on the assumption of a constant ratio are subject to small systematic errors. The magnitude of this error for each past date can in principle be determined with the help of long-lived trees laying down annual growth rings, since the rings can be counted up to obtain an absolute calendar date in the past for each ring. And a carbon sample of wood, dated in this manner, can then be analyzed for its carbon-14, carbon-12 ratio. In this way, measured radiocarbon dates can be calibrated to take account of fluctuations in the atmospheric carbon ratio. The effect of this correction is that, for materials with apparent, that is, uncalibrated dates between about 1,000 and 6,000 BC, the true calibrated date is between a few centuries and 1,000 years earlier. Somewhat older samples have more recently begun to be calibrated by an alternative method based on another radioactive decay process and yielding the conclusion that samples apparently dating to about 9,000 BC actually date to around 11,000 BC. Archaeologists often distinguish calibrated from uncalibrated dates by writing the former in uppercase letters and the latter in lowercase letters. However, the archaeological literature can be confusing in this respect, because many books and papers report uncalibrated dates as BC and fail to mention that they are actually uncalibrated. The dates that I report in this book for events within the last 15,000 years are calibrated dates. That accounts for some of the discrepancies that readers may note between this book's dates and those quoted in some standard reference books on early food production. Once one has recognized and dated ancient remains of domestic plants or animals, how does one decide whether the plant or animal was actually domesticated in the vicinity of that site itself, rather than domesticated elsewhere and then spread to the site? One method is to examine a map of the geographic distribution of the crops or animals' wild ancestor, and to reason that domestication must have taken place in the area where the wild ancestor occurs. For example, chickpeas are widely grown by traditional farmers from the Mediterranean and Ethiopia east to India, with the latter country accounting for 80% of the world's chickpea production today. One might therefore have been deceived into supposing that chickpeas were domesticated in India, but it turns out that ancestral wild chickpeas occur only in southeastern Turkey. The interpretation that chickpeas were actually domesticated there is supported by the fact that the oldest finds of possibly domesticated chickpeas in Neolithic archaeological sites come from southeastern Turkey and nearby northern Syria that date to around 8,000 BC. Not until over 5,000 years later does archaeological evidence of chickpeas appear on the Indian subcontinent. A second method for identifying a crop's or animal's site of domestication is to plot on a map the dates of the domesticated form's first appearance at each locality. The site where it appeared earliest may be its site of initial domestication, especially if the wild ancestor also occurred there, and if the dates of first appearance at other sites become progressively earlier with increasing distance from the putative site of initial domestication, suggesting spread to those other sites. For instance, the earliest known cultivated emmer wheat comes from the Fertile Crescent around 8500 BC. Soon thereafter, the crop appears progressively farther west, reaching Greece around 6500 BC and Germany around 5000 BC. Those dates suggest domestication of emmer wheat in the Fertile Crescent, a conclusion supported by the fact that ancestral wild emmer wheat is confined to the area extending from Israel to western Iran and Turkey. However, as we shall see, complications arise in many cases where the same plant or animal was domesticated independently at several different sites. Such cases can often be detected by analyzing the resulting morphological, genetic, or chromosomal differences between specimens of the same crop or domestic animal in different areas. For instance, India's Zebu breeds of domestic cattle possess humps lacking in Western Eurasian cattle breeds, and genetic analyses show that the ancestors of modern Indian and Western Eurasian cattle breeds diverged from each other hundreds of thousands of years ago, long before any animals were domesticated anywhere. That is, cattle were domesticated independently in India and Western Eurasia within the last 10,000 years, starting with wild Indian and Western Eurasian cattle subspecies that had diverged hundreds of thousands of years earlier. Let's now return to our earlier questions about the rise of food production. Where, when, and how did food production develop in different parts of the globe? At one extreme are areas in which food production arose altogether independently, with the domestication of many indigenous crops, and in some cases animals, before the arrival of any crops or animals from other areas. There are only five such areas for which the evidence is at present detailed and compelling. Southwest Asia, also known as the Near East, or Fertile Crescent, China, Mesoamerica, the term applied to central and southern Mexico and adjacent areas of Central America, the Andes of South America, and possibly the adjacent Amazon Basin as well, and the eastern United States. Some or all of these centers may actually comprise several nearby centers where food production arose more or less independently, such as North China's Yellow River Valley and South China's Yangtze River Valley. In addition to these five areas where food production definitely arose de novo, four others, Africa's Sahel Zone, tropical West Africa, Ethiopia, and New Guinea, are candidates for that distinction. However, there is some uncertainty in each case. Although indigenous wild plants were undoubtedly domesticated in Africa's Sahel Zone just south of the Sahara, cattle herding may have preceded agriculture there, and it is not yet certain whether those were independently domesticated Sahel cattle or, instead, domestic cattle of Fertile Crescent origin, whose arrival triggered local plant domestication. It remains similarly uncertain whether the arrival of those Sahel crops then triggered the undoubted local domestication of indigenous wild plants in tropical West Africa, and whether the arrival of Southwest Asian crops is what triggered the local domestication of indigenous wild plants in Ethiopia. As for New Guinea, Archaeological studies there have provided evidence of early agriculture well before food production in any adjacent areas, but the crops grown have not been definitely identified. Let's look at these and other areas of local domestication, some of the best-known crops and animals, and the earliest known dates of domestication. Among these nine candidate areas for the independent evolution of food production, Southwest Asia has the earliest definite dates for both plant domestication, around 8500 BC, and animal domestication, around 8000 BC. It also has by far the largest number of accurate radiocarbon dates for early food production. Dates for China are nearly as early, while dates for the eastern United States are clearly about 6,000 years later. For the other six candidate areas, the earliest well-established dates do not rival those for Southwest Asia, but too few early sites have been securely dated in those six other areas for us to be certain that they really lagged behind Southwest Asia, and if so, by how much. The next group of areas consists of ones that did domesticate at least a couple of local plants or animals, but where food production depended mainly on crops and animals that were domesticated elsewhere. Those imported domesticates may be thought of as founder crops and animals because they founded local food production. The arrival of founder domesticates enabled local people to become sedentary and thereby increased the likelihood of local crops evolving from wild plants that were gathered, brought home, and planted accidentally, and later planted intentionally. In three or four such areas, the arriving founder package came from Southwest Asia. One of them is Western and Central Europe, where food production arose with the arrival of Southwest Asian crops and animals between 6000 and 3500 BC. But at least one plant, the poppy, and probably oats and some others, was then domesticated locally. Wild poppies are confined to coastal areas of the western Mediterranean. Poppy seeds are absent from excavated sites of the earliest farming communities in Eastern Europe and Southwest Asia. They first appear in early farming sites in Western Europe. In contrast, the wild ancestors of most Southwest Asian crops and animals were absent from Western Europe. Thus, it seems clear that food production did not evolve independently in Western Europe. Instead, it was triggered there by the arrival of Southwest Asian domesticates. The resulting Western European farming societies domesticated the poppy, which subsequently spread eastward as a crop. Another area where local domestication appears to have followed the arrival of Southwest Asian founder crops is the Indus Valley region of the Indian subcontinent. The earliest farming communities there in the 7th millennium BC utilized wheat, barley, and other crops that had been previously domesticated in the Fertile Crescent and that evidently spread to the Indus Valley through Iran. Only later did domesticates derived from indigenous species of the Indian subcontinent, such as humped cattle and sesame, appear in Indus Valley farming communities. In Egypt as well, food production began in the 6th millennium BC with the arrival of Southwest Asian crops. Egyptians then domesticated the sycamore fig and a local vegetable called chufa. The same pattern perhaps applies to Ethiopia, where wheat, barley, and other Southwest Asian crops have been cultivated for a long time. Ethiopians also domesticated many locally available wild species to obtain crops, most of which are still confined to Ethiopia. But one of them, the coffee bean, has now spread around the world. However, it is not yet known whether Ethiopians were cultivating these local plants before or only after the arrival of the Southwest Asian package. In these and other areas where food production depended on the arrival of founder crops from elsewhere, did local hunter-gatherers themselves adopt those founder crops from neighboring farming peoples and thereby become farmers themselves? Or was the founder package instead brought by invading farmers who were thereby enabled to outbreed the local hunters and to kill, displace, or outnumber them? In Egypt, it seems likely that the former happened. Local hunter-gatherers simply added Southwest Asian domesticates and farming and herding techniques to their own diet of wild plants and animals, then gradually phased out the wild foods. That is, what arrived to launch food production in Egypt was foreign crops and animals, not foreign peoples. The same may have been true on the Atlantic coast of Europe, where local hunter-gatherers apparently adopted Southwest Asian sheep and cereals over the course of many centuries. In the Cape of South Africa, The local koi hunter-gatherers became herders, but not farmers, by acquiring sheep and cows from farther north in Africa and ultimately from Southwest Asia. Similarly, Native American hunter-gatherers of the U.S. Southwest gradually became farmers by acquiring Mexican crops. In these four areas, the onset of food production provides little or no evidence for the domestication of local plants.